My voice holds out. I've had a lot of issues with it, and I can't seem to get rid of this congestion. And then not only did I preach at Palatine, I was at the Bartlett Historical Society cemetery walk, and so I had to do 5 rounds of a speech, and it's coming and going. I'd like you to turn, if you would, to Genesis chapter 15. I'm going to get there in just a minute. We're going to be spending most of our time, though, in Deuteronomy and in Judges. The thoughts here came from a lesson that we had yesterday at the men's overnighter from Brother Ryan Boyer at the overnighter, and he called it Trusting God. And it talked about chariots of iron. And I want to talk about chariots of iron that break faith. To give you a little bit of background, as the reading came from Romans chapter 4 about Abraham, there was a great promise made to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. And there's a big turning point in the book of Genesis, the way it's laid out when the call of Abraham happens. Before that, you have 4 events. You have the creation, the fall of man, the flood, and then the table of nations, in which man is spread out into 10 geographic areas. And then when we get to Genesis chapter 12, all of a sudden now, instead of dealing with all of mankind, God is only going to be dealing with the line that goes through the seed of Abraham to Christ. And so instead of 4 events, now it's 4 patriarchs: Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. So Abraham is called in Genesis chapter 12, and we're not going to take the time to read the first 4 verses. There's actually a 7-fold promise there, because 4 of them are more directly concerning Abraham, and the number 7 being a perfect number. The 3 that are consequential, though, are the nation promise that's made to Abraham, that God is going to make a great nation out of him, and then the land promise. He's going to give that nation a land in which to dwell. And then, of course, the seed or the offspring promise: through his seed, all nations of the earth would be blessed. And, of course, Paul makes it very clear from Galatians chapter 3 that seed is Christ. So when we see when that's made to Abraham, and that promise gets repeated throughout the rest of the book of Genesis, Abraham is 75 years old at that point. The year is 2091 B.C., and it's 645 years before they cross the river into Canaan to inherit the land. We want to note a couple of things. In Genesis chapter 13, verse 16, he's told that as the dust of the earth is, so shall his descendants be. And then we get to chapter 15, and let's look what God tells him there. Chapter 15, verses 5 and 6. He brought him outside and said, "Look toward heaven and number the stars if you are able to number them." Then he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." And he believed the Lord, and he counted it to him as righteousness. And of course, that verse is repeated many times in the New Testament, because Abraham had this blind faith, this blind trust, and therefore God counted it to him as righteousness. But there's another thing. Besides Israel getting the land, there was an iniquity problem with all the tribes of the land. If we read farther down in verse 12, we're going to find out about the Amorites. Starting in verse 12, "As the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram, and behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. Then the Lord said to Abram, 'Know for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted for 400 years. But I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. As for yourself, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age, and they shall come back here in the 4th generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete.'" Now, there are a couple of different words for generation in Hebrew. There's one that would talk about subsequent generations, for example, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. This particular one has a time element to it, and it's counted as 100 years. And this is the time factor for the Old Testament until Numbers 14, when the lifespans are shorter and the generations are counted as 40 years. So he lets him know that they're going to be afflicted very much, very hard. And they're going to have a hard time, but they're going to come out with great possession. When we look in Exodus chapter 12, verses 40 and 41, this is at the end of the bondage that starts when Jacob goes down into Egypt in Genesis 46. And it says that the time that they were there was exactly 430 years to the very day. Well, this is part of the prophecy that they would be afflicted. This is part of the time that's being consumed for his descendants before they get to go into the land. And they're a nation at this point. When we get to the book of Deuteronomy, and you can go ahead and turn there because we're going to be spending some time there, we're at the last 40 days of Moses' life. Moses was 120, and remember that he was not allowed to enter the promised land because of his rebellion at the waters of Meribah and when he didn't give God the glory. The time frame here is the last 40 days. We catch that from looking at Deuteronomy 1:3 as well as 34:8. And after he speaks, then he dies, and then they are in mourning for 30 days. The 40 and 30, again, being 70 days. Another oft-repeating number in the Bible. But let's look now, and let's look at the reputation. Let's look at what God was doing for his people. Because so many times we fall victim to the same thing. God has made so many provisions for us to be saved. So many helps along the way. And sometimes we just thumb our nose or we turn our backs and we don't care. Or maybe we don't realize. But look what's happening. Go to chapter 2 of Deuteronomy. And what does it say in verse 25? God talking, "This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you on the peoples who are under the whole heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you." This previously unknown nation of Israel that grew up for 430 years in Egypt now is going to be a fear and a terror of the land. And part of the thing, not only are they going to inherit the land, but it's a punishment on the Amorites, which comes to be the larger tribe there. And it becomes a generic term for all seven of the nations that are part of the prophecy to be kicked out because of their iniquity. Go with me now to chapter 4, where there's a warning given in verse 1. "And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the rules that I am teaching you, and do them, that you may live, and go in and take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you." Go down to verse 5. There we read, "See, I have taught you statutes and rules, as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. Keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, 'Surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today?'" Notice that they are called a nation. The nation promised to Abraham is fulfilled. They are a nation at this point, and they're about to go over and inherit the land that God also promised to give them. Look at some of the blessings. Go to chapter 6, and we want to look in starting in verse 10. "And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give you with great and good cities that you did not build." Now notice these blessings, because they were to destroy the people, not the land itself. "Great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not fill, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, then take care lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you. For the Lord your God is in your midst is a jealous God, lest the anger of the Lord your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test, as you tested him at Massah. You shall diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, and his testimonies, his statutes, which he has commanded you. There's absolutely no mystery about these commands. God wants them to be faithful. God is giving them all kinds of gifts and blessings. This is what we call grace, something they didn't earn. They didn't do anything to deserve this. It was all part of a promise to Abraham. And they were to be faithful and keep the statutes. And they were not to adhere to the peoples of the land and pick up their abominations and their sins and go against God. What about detesting idolatry? Go to chapter 7. Let's look at the first 5 verses here. When the Lord your God brings you into the land that you are entering to take possession of it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, 7 nations more numerous and mightier than yourselves. Notice that, more numerous and mightier than yourselves. And when the Lord your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must devote them to complete destruction. That means destroy them. Don't let them live. Because of their iniquity, this is punishment upon the peoples of the land. You shall make no covenant with them and show no mercy to them. You shall not intermarry with them, giving your daughters to their sons or taking their daughters for your sons, for they would turn away your sons from following me to serve other gods. Then the anger of the Lord would be kindled against you, and he would destroy you quickly. But thus you shall deal with them. You shall break down their altars and dash in pieces their pillars and chop down their asherim and burn their carved images with fire. It's extremely clear what they are to do. They're to go into the land and get rid of all the filth, all the abominations of all of this idolatry, and not adhere to it. God is telling them what to do, and he's telling them that he's going to help them to conquer all these things that are greater and mightier than they. What about fear not? What about the hornets that are going to go before them? Go down to verse 17 of chapter 7. If you say in your heart, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? You shall not be afraid of them, but you shall remember what the Lord your God did to Pharaoh and to all Egypt. The great trials that your eyes saw, the signs, the wonders, the mighty hand, and the outstretched arm by which the Lord your God brought you out. So will the Lord your God do to all the peoples of whom you are afraid. Moreover, the Lord your God will send hornets among them until those who are left and hide themselves from you are destroyed. You shall not be in dread of them, for the Lord your God is in your midst, a great and awesome God. The Lord your God will clear away these nations before you, little by little. You may not make an end of them at once, lest the wild beasts grow too numerous for you. But the Lord your God will give them over to you and throw them into great confusion until they are destroyed. And he will give their kings into your hand, and you shall make their name perish from under the heaven. No one shall be able to stand against you until you have destroyed them. The carved images of their gods you shall burn with fire. You shall not cover the silver or the gold that is on them, or take it for yourselves, lest you be ensnared by it. For it is an abomination to the Lord your God, and you shall not bring an abominable thing into your house and become devoted to destruction and like it. You shall utterly detest and abhor it, for it is devoted to destruction. Absolutely no doubt what Moses is telling him. Deuteronomy in Greek means the second naming, the second giving of the law. He's repeating what had been done in Exodus because he's about to die. So this is going to be fresh in their memories. But the problem is they're going to forget. And he's even telling them it's not going to be destroyed all at one time. There were 6 years of heavy conquest and 25 years of fighting so that the land would little by little be taken so that it wouldn't be overgrown with beasts and weeds and everything else, because they were to inherit things that they had not even planted or built. God was being good to them. God was helping them. He was doing all that he could. Go to chapter 8 and verses 19 and 20. And if you forget the Lord your God and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I solemnly warn you today that you shall surely perish. Like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so shall you perish because you would not obey the voice of the Lord your God. Absolutely no doubt what God intends for them. In Leviticus 18, verses 24 through 30, he talks about some of the abominations of the land, and he says the land is vomiting out its inhabitants because of the abominations. He's making it very clear to them that they are to get rid of all this filth and not take on their habits. What about the rules? Go to chapter 10, verses 12 and 13. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, and to keep the commandments and statutes of the Lord, which I am commanding you today for your good. He is commanding them for their good so that they may live and live in peace and be happy. In verse 22 of chapter 10, he talks about how they were 70 people that went down into Egypt, and now they are as the stars of heaven. We already saw that in Genesis, that Abraham was promised that. And Moses says that has already occurred. Do not follow the abominations of the Canaanites. Chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. When we move on to the book of Joshua, we're not going to take the time, but sometime read Joshua chapter 1. Essentially, Joshua is given all of this in a nutshell. He's given the very same promises that were given to Moses. And the interesting thing, Joshua is the Hebrew form of the Greek Jesus. His name means Savior, because he's going to bring them into a promised land. Just as Jesus is going to bring us into a spiritual promised land. So now we see that there are things happening. Joshua chapter 1, he's going to make these same promises. Now hold your finger here, and you don't have to turn. I'm going to read two verses back in Deuteronomy before I talk about Rahab the harlot to show you what's happening, how God keeps his promise. 2:25, we already read that. This day I will begin to put the dread and fear of you on the peoples who are under the whole of heaven, who shall hear the report of you and shall tremble and be in anguish because of you. Chapter 11, verse 25, a similar thought is there. No one shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will lay the fear of you and the dread of you on all the land that you shall tread, as he promised you. Now we're in Joshua, and we go to chapter 2, and we're going to look at verses 8 to 11. And we're going to find out about the spies who went there, and Rahab the harlot, Rahab the prostitute. There are different words in the Old Testament for different types of prostitutes. Some of them are what they call temple prostitutes. They were given over to paganism. They would have to spend several weeks or a month doing their duties. They were sexual duties to the priests of their foreign gods. That's not the case with Rachel. She was a slut. She was a whore. She was an outright prostitute. That's what the word means. There was nothing religious about her life. But she's in the honor roll of faith in Hebrews 11, and she's in the genealogy of Christ because this woman turned her life around. Her faith had works. Her faith did something. And she rehearses this now to the spies. Go with it to chapter 2 of Joshua, starting in verse 8. Before the men lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to them, I know that the Lord, and notice it's all in caps, this is God's covenant name, Yahweh or Jehovah. I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. What did God promise through Moses? He said this very thing would happen. And now here's a woman of ill repute, and she fears God. And she says, we know this. We know that God has given you our land. For we have heard how the Lord, again Yahweh, dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. They did what they were told to do. They got rid of them. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord, for Yahweh, your God, He is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. This is a woman whose faith is going to turn her life around. She already believes in the Lord, and she's asking for salvation from them. And you know the story, how they put the cord out there and her family was saved. And everything else was destroyed. You see, they were going to inherit all the stuff in Canaan. But the first fruits, the first thing destroyed was Jericho. And that was to be devoted to God. God got the whole thing. God always gets the first and the best. And she negotiated this with them. She hid the spies. She lied about them. And then down in verse 24, and they said to Joshua, this is after they returned, truly the Lord has given all the land into our hands, and also all the inhabitants of the land melt away because of us. Isn't that interesting? They know God's promise. They don't misunderstand it, and they witnessed it through Rahab. They knew this was going to take place. And this is what God wanted them to do. Put God first, and you shall not perish. Put God first, and do His commands, and don't adhere yourselves to the idols of the land. And get rid of them. The land's going to vomit them out. You know, when you go to 1 Corinthians 6, it talks about the works of the flesh, all kinds of evil people, even homosexuality. And he says, such were some of you. But you were washed, you were justified, you were sanctified in the blood of Christ. That's what Rahab has done. She has changed. She has become one of them. Or she's about to. See, her faith is leading her to do these works. The spies believed it. Now let's go to the book of Judges, and we're going to be spending most of our time here. We're going to see what happens. Judges, what happens is the first generation, they wander around the wilderness. The second generation goes into the land, and they're not faithful. They're somewhat faithful until Joshua and the elders die. And then you're going to have eight generations, 320 years of spiraling downward until Saul becomes king in 1046. You're going to see them go out of whack, desert the Lord, violate all these commands that were given to Joshua, to Moses. We're going to look at, and this was part of the lesson yesterday, there are five principles that set out the guidelines or set out the outline for the whole rest of Judges right here in chapter 1. The first three verses of the book. After the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites to fight against us? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up. Behold, I have given the land into his hand. And Judah said to Simeon, his brother, come up with me into the territory allotted to me, that we may fight against the Canaanites. And I likewise will go with you into the territory allotted to you. So Simeon went with him. This is the ideal. This is what they were supposed to do. Wouldn't it be great if everything got rubber stamped after this? Wouldn't it be great if all the other tribes did the same thing? We're going to help you. We're going to fight them. We're going to get rid of this idolatry in the land. And we're going to live at peace with our God. But that didn't happen. Now already we're going to see a little change. Go down to verses 17 through 19. And here's where we get the chariots of iron. And Judah went with Simeon, his brother, and they defeated the Canaanites who inhabited Zephath and devoted it to destruction. Great, that's what they were supposed to do. So the name of the city was called Hormah. Judah also captured Gaza with its territory, and Ashkelon with its territory, and Ekron with its territory. This would be Philistine areas. And the Lord was with Judah, and he took possession of the hill country, but he could not drive out the inhabitants of the plain because they had chariots of iron. What had God told them in Deuteronomy? He said, don't fear these nations that are stronger or mightier than you. So these chariots of iron were going to be a problem. They said, we can't do it. So they didn't do it. And yet, chariots of iron were confounded. That's what the Egyptians had. That's what Pharaoh chased the children of Israel with. And their wheels came off. And they locked up. Because God was fighting for them. And God would have done the same thing for them. So now we get to a situation basically of, I can't. The reference for Pharaoh would have been Deuteronomy 7:17. Now let's go to the next little section, verses 20 and 21. And Hebron was given to Caleb as Moses had said. And he drove out from it the three sons of Anak. Those were the giants. But the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin and Jerusalem to this day. Isn't that sad? They did not drive out the Jebusites. It has nothing here about ability. They just didn't do it. So now we went from I can't do it to I won't do it. They did not obey the command of God and drive out these wicked people. Now let's see a sadder thing down in verses 31 and 32. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Acco or the inhabitants of Sidon or of Alab or of Akzib or of Helba or of Aphek or of Rehob. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. Sad. They lived among the Canaanites. And they weren't supposed to do that. They were supposed to utterly destroy the Canaanites. But they did not do it. It gets worse. Verse 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh or the inhabitants of Beth Anath. So they lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Nevertheless, the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh and of Beth Anath became subject to forced labor for them. Oh, now isn't this interesting? Now, hey, instead of driving them out, let's have forced labor. Hey, God, you said to destroy them, but we got a better idea. We're going to subject them to forced labor. We're going to make them work for us. We're going to enslave them. But that's not what God told them to do. He told them to destroy them. Then we get down here to Dan. The Amorites passed the people of Dan back in... pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. The Amorites persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres and in Ajalon and in Shaalbim, but the hand of the house of Joseph rested heavily on them, and they became subject to forced labor. And the border of the Amorites ran from the ascent of Akrabim from Selah and upward. Wait a minute. The border of the Amorites is defined. They were supposed to be destroyed. But look at the difference in wording as we progressed down through the chapter. In verse 21, we found out that the people of Benjamin did not drive out the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem. So the Jebusites have lived with the people of Benjamin in Jerusalem to this day. So Benjamin had the upper hand, and these pagans lived with them. Now we get to down to... 34 and 36. Hold on a second here. In verse 34, the Amorites pressed the people of Dan. And then we see that they persisted in dwelling in Mount Heres. And then we see here that... back in verse 32. So the Asherites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land. Well, back in verse 21, the Jebusites lived among the Benjamites. Now, the Asherites are living among the Canaanites. The Canaanites are the dominant people. It's their land, and Asher is just dwelling with them. And they were supposed to destroy them. Now, the ironic part is we had moved down here when it talked about Dan. Samson was from Dan. And there's more about Samson in the book of Judges. And even with his moral flaws, he dies there at the end of chapter 16. There's more here about Samson than most of the people in the Old Testament. You have big chapter space with David and with Solomon and some of the others like that. But Samson takes up a big space here for what he did, because he was one of them that pulled things down. So what happens is, until you get to chapter 3, verse 5, you have living with the Canaanites. And through the end of chapter 16, you have warring with the Canaanites. And starting in chapter 17 till the end, you have living like the Canaanites, because they did not obey God's command. And all the promises that He had made, they made bargains with the people. They failed. Chapter 2, begin with me in verse 1. Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you out of Egypt and brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars, but you have not obeyed my voice. What is this you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your sides, and their God shall be a snare to you. As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept, and they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land, and the people served Joshua all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great work that the Lord had done for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years, and they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the Mount of Gaash. And all that generation, this is the second generation, also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that He had done for Israel. Isn't that sad? And Moses had told them to teach your children, and they didn't do it. And Joshua died in 1375 BC, and that generation lasted another 9 years, and then it went kaput for 320 years from 1366 to 1046 BC. Spiraling downward, they never would get back to the plateau that they had left when the judges were raised to help them, because they did not obey God. It was a horrible situation. If we look here, starting in verse 11, and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from whom the gods of the peoples who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger, and they abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Asherah. Basically, the sun and the moon gods. Baal was the male god. Asherah was the female counterpart, the moon god. These were all sexual things, and they serve these idols instead of the Lord. And when we get to the Babylonian captivity, this idolatry had even infiltrated the temple because they did not obey God. Before we look at the invitation, go to chapter 3, verses 5 through 7. So the people of Israel lived among the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And their daughters they took to themselves for wives, and their own daughters they gave to their sons, and they served their gods. All these nations are still left in Canaan. And they were to utterly destroy them. They were not to intermarry and weaken their influence to God. And people fall to the same pattern today. And they forsake God and they weaken. In chapter 4, verse 3, we're not going to read it, but 900 chariots were routed. That's also in verses 14 and 15. In Psalm 20 and verse 7, it talks about trust or faith. And it says you're going to trust in chariots, in horses, or in God. The same thing in Isaiah 31, verses 1 through 3. Two final passages for the invitation. Let's go back to Romans 4, where you had the reading. And let's see this great promise made to Abraham. Abraham had the faith, but his descendants did not. Why do people give up on believing in and obeying God? Can start in the middle of the sentence there in verse 17. As it is written, I have made you the father of many nations in the presence of the God in whom he believed, who gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. In hope he, that's Abraham, believed. Believed is the verb form of faith. Against hope, that he should become the father of many nations, as he had been told, so shall your offspring be. He did not weaken in faith, literally in trust, when he considered his own body, which was as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, or when he considered the barrenness of Sarah's womb, just as we're told in Hebrews 11, they were no longer able to procreate. His body was sexually dead. No distrust. Or disbelief, or lack of faith, literally distrust, made him waver concerning the promise of God, but he grew strong in his faith as he gave glory to God, but convinced that God was able to do what he had promised. That is why his faith was counted to him as righteousness. But the words that was counted to him were not written for his sake alone, but for ours also. It will be counted to us who believe in him, who raised from the dead Jesus our Lord, who was delivered up for our trespasses and raised for our justification, or for making us righteousness, making us righteous rather. It will be counted to us who believe. These things were not written for Abraham alone. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, chapter 10, twice, Paul says that these things were written down for our admonition, for our teaching, to warn us about these Old Testament examples, how their distrust, their lack of faith, caused them not to be saved. What about you and your lack of faith? Go to 2 Corinthians 5. Where do you stand with God? Chapter 5, verse 10. Oops, I'm in 1 Corinthians. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. That's all we can do, is persuade others and say, look, the day is coming. This great day of the dawning of eternity, when all this filth and trash and everything that Satan puts before us shall cease, and we will serve the Lord if we are faithful. Finally, down in the next chapter, verse 14 of chapter 6, do not be unequally yoked, literally to, not with, do not be unequally yoked to unbelievers. And then he has all these rhetorical questions, because the answer is obvious. There is no fellowship. There is no agreement. There is nothing in common with all these questions that are posed. And we saw that difference in Judges, how the Jebusites lived with the Benjamites, but the Asherites lived with the Canaanites. So the Asherites were unequally yoked to the unbelievers. That was not the case technically with Benjamin, because the unbelievers lived among them. And that's the difference. Do not be unequally yoked. Therefore, verse 17, go out from their midst and be separate from them. That's exactly what the Lord told Israel. Chapter 7, verse 1, since we have these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from every defilement of body and spirit, bringing holiness to completion in the fear of God. Bringing holiness to completion. The judgment seat of Christ is there, waiting for time to end. And in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 through 28, Jesus paid a huge price. Because at the end, when he turns the kingdom over to God, and death is no more, because that's the last enemy, Jesus himself subject himself to God. And out equal to God. 1:1-3. He paid a price to redeem us. And where are we with him? Are we giving God leftovers? Or are we willing to say, follow no matter what comes my way? If you need to put on the Lord, if you're subject to him for the first time or the umpteenth time or whatever it takes, or you need the prayers of the congregation, that's what this time is set aside for. Now, while together we stand.